Yo, what's up everyone? It's Justin from Rapzilla, and we are back with another episode of the CHH-ish podcast. And we've got a really good one today because we're veering off the course of CHH, and we are speaking to an author, pastor, PhD named Michael Caparelli, who wrote a book called Monster Mirror, and it's about David Berkowitz, aka the serial killer, son of Sam, and his conversion to Christianity, and trying to get into his head and see what that conversion was like and how a convicted serial killer can go from a psychopath as the son of Sam to a child of God. So Michael's going to be joining us in the live, and we're going to be talking about that. If you are a fan of true crime documentaries and all that good stuff, this is the one that you want to be here with. All right, so let's see. Let's get a little post in here so everyone knows what's happening. And let's wait for Michael to join us. Can everyone hear me okay? What's up, Eric Nelson? How's everybody doing? Can you guys hear me okay? Previously, what's up, Opto? Previously on this show, the first episode, we had Monster Tarver. The second episode, we had Hurt, RPH. Monster Tarver spoke about his entire career as a WWE wrestler and also a bit of an AFL football player. So that was something outside of CHH that maybe people didn't know. Second episode was about Hurt, who spoke about how he almost went to prison for 15 years for a crime that he didn't commit. So now we're actually kind of continuing on this, I call it a crime spree, a crime theme. And now speaking to Michael Caparelli, who actually joined the chat. What's up, Michael? I sent you an invite to go live. All right, it says you're unable to join. Okay, let me see. View request. Hello.
Are we good?
We're good. I think we're live.
Oh, excellent.
Can you hear me? Can you see me? Everything good?
I can see you perfectly. How about myself? Can you see me okay?
Yeah, you're good. You're fine. Last week I went live with someone and everyone could see us, but he said he couldn't see me. So I was like, okay, so I guess we'll treat this like a phone call. Basically, you're not going to see me. But all right, everyone sees us. Everyone hears us. I'm super excited. When you sent in that email that first time, and I was like, this is Rapzilla. We talk about Christian hip hop, but this, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with this, but I definitely want to have this conversation. So I'm going to figure out a whole way to make this happen. So this podcast that we do, the CHH-ish podcast, Christian hip hop kinda-ish podcast. So that's how I'm able to fit this in. I guess I'll ask you just this off the top. Do you know anything about Christian hip hop or Christian rap?
Yeah, I mean, when I gave my life to Christ back in the 90s, mid-90s, 28 years ago, the Christian hip hop world was a lot smaller. But one of my good friends at the time, he might even be tuned in, Derek Colon, he had a ministry, because I'm from the, you know, the streets. Most of the kids I grew up with in the neighborhood listened to hip hop back in the days of Tupac and Biggie and what have you. But I get saved in a church where the guy there, the youth pastor, was very active in reaching out to the hip hop community. So yeah, it's definitely my background. Not my cup of tea. But I'm very familiar with hip hop.
All right. So you got that out of the way. So now everybody watching or who listens later, see, we made it. We made an avenue. We made it work. So everyone, this is Michael Caparelli. He wrote this book called Monster Mirror, where he spent 100 hours plus, right, with David Berkowitz, a.k.a. the son of Sam serial killer. And you spoke about his transformation from a psychopath to a believer. And kind of all the in-between, the mental gymnastics maybe that people have to do, that he himself has to do. And it's just a fascinating topic. So I definitely want to dive into it. But before we get there, like, why don't you tell people more about yourself? I know I saw that you said you were actually incarcerated for a little bit. You got saved. You became a pastor somewhere in there. You got a PhD. Then you started writing books. Now you're talking to David Berkowitz. So bring us on the timeline of everything.
Well, prisoners has always been something close to my heart. I was a young boy visiting my father in prison. Okay. An Italian American families where dad is in prison. The euphemism is school. So I say, Ma, where are we going? And she says, we're going to go visit dad in school.
In college, right?
Yeah, in college. I said, what's he majoring in? She says, law. So I was already acclimated to the prison world at a young age. And then at 17, I'm in trouble with the law. I was a troubled kid, me and two other kids, and we end up in juvenile detention. I hear the gospel at 17, locked up behind bars. And I give my life to Christ at 18. My whole life changes. I never go back. And then, go forward, get a bachelor's and a master's degree in theology, become a pastor. The church that I pastored was very much involved with people from the streets, prison ministry. So I've been working with inmates for a long time in three different prisons. Wow. Somewhere in the process of pastoring, after already having the master's and the bachelor's, I decided to pursue a doctorate degree in behavioral science. Behavioral science is a combination of psychology, criminology, sociology, all the ologies of behavior.
Yeah.
And that took about 7 years to finish that PhD full time while I was pastoring the church. And then I resigned from pastoring after two heart attacks. About 4 or 5 years ago, and decided to, with the PhD, I had colleges opening their doors for me to teach. Right now, I teach at three colleges. I teach psychology. I teach criminal psychology, abnormal psych. So now I'm a resource in the church when it comes to mental health issues. I've written several books about mental health. I mailed one of those books, Dr. Jesus. I mailed it. It's a book on mental health from a biblical perspective, what the Bible has to say, mixed with the science on depression, anxiety, OCD. I mailed that book, Dr. Jesus, to David Berkowitz, inmate 78A, 1976, at Shawgun Correctional in New York. And he must have read it in about 2 weeks because he responded pretty quickly. And he basically said, I've been waiting for a guy like you that is a Christian, understands the Bible, but has a doctorate in psychology and can articulate some of the psychological breakdowns that were happening in my mind back in the 70s when I gunned down 13 people, lit 1,400 fires, and held New York City in a state of fear for about 16 months, taunting the media, the NYPD with letters, catch me if you can. So I took him up on his invitation. And we began the longest case study, I mean, going about it scientifically, the longest case study, a qualitative research study on David Berkowitz ever in 46 years of incarceration. I met with David for 34 sessions, face-to-face, three to 3.5 hour long sessions, semi-structured interviews. Collected the data to find out what were these mental health factors and how did it correlate with the demonic behind his serial killings.
Yeah, phenomenal stuff. What's funny is you hit on small portions of like a couple of different questions I had. So I'm going to go back a little bit. When you sent him that book, Dr. Jesus, what compelled you to do that? And what were you hoping happened once you sent him the book?
You know, I had no expectations other than blessing him. Once again, being a child of a man in prison at a young age,
right,
and also being incarcerated, just the compassion of Christ. Let me bless David Berkowitz. Yeah. I know he's been behind bars for a long time. I heard his story in the 700 Club, not expecting a letter back. I was pretty shocked when the letter came and said, love to meet you, read your book, love your book, and responded with an open mind. And then when I showed up at session one, it was in April 1st, 2022, I knew fairly early on that we were going to begin a journey together of telling his story and conducting this qualitative research on the mental health factors behind the crimes.
Yeah, so what, I guess, what was the preparation for that? Like, what did you do behind the scenes in meeting him? And then even, what was that emotion? What was running through your head the first time where you meet him and you're like, hi, you know, is it nice to meet you or great to see you? Like, it's kind of weird because this guy killed all those people. And it's like, you wouldn't think of like, oh, let me shake this guy's hand. I'm so happy to meet you. Like, it's just, it's a weird thing, I think, for most people to grasp their head around.
Yeah, I've been asked that question often. I wouldn't say there was any fear. I'm not trying to sound like a tough guy, but I was acclimated to a crisis at a young age, and I feel more comfortable than most people in some pretty tense situations. So that wasn't the issue. Awkwardness, yes. I mean, this is like one of America's most notorious.
Right. He's a celebrity.
He's a celebrity within the you know, the murder domain. And you've seen his face a million times on television, documentaries. So a bit awkward. David made the awkwardness dissolve pretty quickly. He's very friendly. He's very brotherly. At 71 years old, he's very buoyant. He didn't just walk into the room. He, like, sprinted in. I couldn't believe his energy. Usually lifers, you know, they sort of embrace this kind of helpless, institutionalized mentality. I don't know a busier guy in my life. I talk to David on the phone once a week. I visit him once a month, even now after the case study. We email back and forth. I don't know a busier guy. He takes that time behind bars seriously and devotes all of his time to the ministry of Christ.
So how does a guy as infamous and, as we said, celebrity status as him, how is he like so accessible to you?
Well, he's just as any other inmate. He has the right to receive mail, phone calls, visits. I mean, that's pretty par for the course. It's you know, it's just the rights of inmates. Now, a guy like him is typically, and he always has been, picky about who he meets.
Right, I've seen.
So I show up first visit. I show my credentials. Now, that makes things easier. You know, if you're a reverend and you're a doctor, that certainly sets the stage. But the CO, the correctional officer, you know, he asked the question. He goes, does David know you're here? I said, yeah. He said, well, he doesn't. I'm surprised. He said, you know, he's very persnickety or selective and discriminating in who he meets. And it was I think that book, Dr. Jesus, is really what caused his walls to come down. We had also some mutual experiences. Okay. David has a passion for Teen Challenge ministry. He's actually worked with Teen Challenge behind bars. Teen Challenge, Don Wilkerson, David Wilkerson's brother, who's a mentor of mine. Don has worked with David in the past. He's produced a documentary on David's testimony back in the 90s. So we had some common ground between us that made it a little bit easier too.
Okay. Yeah. That definitely breaks down some barriers. So obviously we all have a past. You said you have a past. So when David's talking about his past, is it difficult to kind of see past those horrific things he's telling you and trying to compartmentalize it as, oh, this is just data? Because he's talking about people, and he's talking about murders, he's talking about the loss of life, but you're kind of analytically viewing it. So, like, how are you receiving that information as he's telling it to you?
Well, let's not forget, I have four daughters.
Yeah.
So there were definitely moments, you know, we're talking about young ladies murdered in cold blood. Yeah. No rhyme or reason. His last victim, Stacy Moskowitz, probably the most famous 21-year-old blonde who left the house that night. Mom Nasa said, Stacy, please be careful. There's a madman at loose. He's taunting the media. He's writing letters to the police. He's leaving the letters at the scene of the crimes. She said, "Mom, don't worry. I'm blonde. He's not targeting blondes. I have a blonde daughter, Ashley. I've got other daughters. So I'm hearing these stories and empathizing with these victims. I mean, I'm not just an analyst. I'm also a very empathetic guy. In fact, the empathy and the analysis kind of go hand in hand. I believe you need empathy to do this because you have to be able to put yourself in the shoes of someone else emotionally and cognitively. There's cognitive empathy, there's emotional empathy. So that definitely, I had my moments where I had to catch my breath and even took some space. You know, maybe didn't respond to an email as quickly as I would have because it was kicking up some stuff inside. But I had to keep going back to the cross. I had to keep going back to the plan of redemption, keep going back to the fact that David is a new creation, not perfect, by no means. He has some character defects, just like we all do. In fact, we discussed some of those present day, even as a believer of 35 years of walking with Christ, some of those character defects, the things that God is doing with him, even today in the book. But I have my moments that I had to take space during those particular times, especially when we talked about the crimes.
Yeah. Now, what about for him? What lens does he view this through now? Is it like, because obviously, you know, saying he was possessed or talking to the dog, you hear all these things. Like, was that like a dream state for him, almost like he views it like? Or is it like a vivid, like, I knew that this happened and I could still see it like it just happened?
Well, David did call it a spell. But, you know, a spell, we tend to think like person's walking around in a trance 24/7. Right. That's just not how it was.
Right, right.
He worked at the post office. He went to his job at the post office. He communicated and commiserated with other colleagues at the post office. You know, he actually walked women to their car because they were afraid of being gunned down by the Son of Sam. How does David explain the crimes? He understands that it's a combination of the psychological and the diabolical. David had some psychological breakdowns from the age of 5, and those risk factors, if you want to use clinical terms, those risk factors put him in a position of being vulnerable towards predatory, paranormal entities. I mean, demons are predators. Yeah. They prey on the weak.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you think of a demon as a predator, and then you think of a young boy, and I discussed those risk factors in the book. I discussed the shaming that he experienced at a young age. I'm not making excuses. There are no excuses for his crimes, but there are some explanations that we can hopefully all learn from. An excuse pardons him from the consequence. Like, may I be excused?
Yeah.
We're not excusing him, but an explanation helps to shed light. And some of those explanations in the book, we talk about the shaming. He had teachers in school that would take his desk because he was hyperactive, put it in the middle of a classroom and say to the other students, this is where the bad boys sit. And he hated going to school. He would, whatever he could to get out of that. Severe abandonment trauma at a young age, which I describe in the book. Isolation, inability to bond. All of these things, head trauma, they put him in a position of being vulnerable. And now let's get this straight too. David came to many intersections where he made choices, okay? It's not just what happened to him, but it's how he responded. He made choices, and when you make choices, those choices make you.
Yeah.
You evolve into something. One of the challenges I have in this book, it's really for a culture that kind of believes that psychopaths and narcissists are other people. I mean, you go on social media, everybody's ex is a narcissist. Everybody else is the psychopath. Yep. Okay. We have a culture that is very in tune with everybody else, but very lacking in being self-reflective.
Yeah, it's never you. You're never you.
You're never the narcissist. A million selfies, right? I mean, it's always somebody else. Well, my challenge in the book is there's a psychopath, a potential psychopath in anybody. If you over the resentments that you have towards somebody for about 6 months. I mean, brood over every resentment, every betrayal, every injury. Brood over it for 6 months. Look in the mirror, berate yourself. Say awful things about who you are. Isolate, pull away from community. You will be shocked at what you evolve into. Now, this idea that we have a hidden psychopath, you know, it flies in the face of contemporary culture, because contemporary culture says it's the other guy. It's not, it's a certain breed of people. But the ancients understood this. I mean, the Bible makes it clear the heart of man is wicked and deceitful above all things. Not the heart of a psychopath, the heart of mankind. Mm-hmm. And then you have centuries of literature in psychology, in fiction. I mean, go to the 1800s, Crime and Punishment by Fyodor Dostoevsky. And he talks about an average man becoming psychopathic and describes that process in detail. Yeah. So we live in a very humanistic society that tells us we're wonderful people and the psychopath is the other person. But Monster Mirror, my book, is saying there are no other people, that anyone has the potential to be violent. It's an evolution. It doesn't happen overnight, but over a process. It can build. And David Berkowitz, he started out as a baby, a young boy, and eventually evolved into a serial killer.
Yeah, it's that, like, in your 700 Club interview, they mentioned the Germans from World War II. Now there's that documentary on Netflix, Ordinary Men. These were ordinary men who went to work, they had a family, and then they were, you know, these killers in concentration camps and in war. And I mean, it's just a switch. Right.
So we read history. We tend to, when we read history, put ourselves in the shoes of the heroes. Yeah. But probability, if you lived in 1940 Germany, you would not be on the right side of history. More than likely,
right.
You would be looking back retrospectively at things you did that you wish you didn't do, and things you didn't do that you wish you did do. And Germany 1940 is just one example. I mean, I could take you down a trip throughout history to show you that mankind is depraved, that the Homo sapien has a potential for violence, and pretty much law and order is what keeps that at bay.
Yeah.
It abates
it.
So this idea that psychopaths are this other breed of people, it's so far from me, so different. It's a contemporary idea. It's probably about 30, 40 years old. You look at the literature throughout the centuries, it's clear that mankind is wicked and deceitful and is capable of anything.
Yeah. So changing subjects a little bit, one thing I've heard, I feel like, said many times about society's worst people that are now Christians and in prison, it's like, well, it's because they have nothing else to do, or, oh, how convenient. Now that they're doing the time, now they can ask for forgiveness. So, like, what would you say to that? And where do you think David fits in that spectrum?
Well, let me answer the first question by saying anyone that comes to Christ, I'll guarantee you, crisis led you to Christ. You came to the end of yourself, and it brought you to the beginning of God. So you can point your finger at the inmate and say, oh, how convenient, in prison they came to Christ. But what was your prison? What was your circumstance? What crisis brought you to Christ? Because typically that's how it goes. We come to the end of ourselves, come to the beginning of God. Now, the question on David, of course, has been said, jailhouse conversion. Well, I've worked with inmates for 20 years. Jailhouse conversions typically last between 3 months to 6 months. It's usually right before a parole hearing to make a good impression on a parole board.
There's the convenience.
Absolutely. Yeah. David Berkowitz has been a Christian for 35 years.
And he has no chance. He has no chance of parole.
No, actually he does. He has parole hearings every 2 years. He'll be facing the parole board in June. He blew off more than half of those parole hearings because he really has no interest at getting out, but it was perceived by the parole board and families of victims as arrogant. So he shows up to share his testimony. He shares his testimony. He has no expectations of leaving. But the idea of him being a jailhouse conversion, to fake that for 35 years, to be as involved involved and invested in his Christian walk in the prison, mentoring 15 guys, meeting with them every week, responding to mail around the world. I mean, suicidal teenagers write him, people at the cusp of destruction write him letters. They're expecting grace. They figure he's not going to throw stones. In fact, he had the campus serial killer, the guy who killed four in Utah, Kohlberger, a year and a half ago, wrote David Berkowitz. So you got people that are writing him, and you know, here he is responding, taking the time. This man takes the time to respond to so many letters to share his testimony. You can't fake that. Now, here's the other deal. I sat with him for 100 hours.
Yeah.
I didn't just see David Berkowitz's actions. People say actions is the best test of character. You can put on an act. There's something more profound than actions. I saw his reactions. Reactions are actions in real time. Actions when a man is caught off guard, unscripted, taken by surprise. I saw him angry. I showed up at one session. I describe it in chapter 2 of the book Monster Mirror. By the way, you can order it on Amazon. I dropped the price for today's show. Chapter 2, he's angry. I show up. He's had an argument with an inmate. He didn't really say much. The inmate degraded him. And David is enraged. And I watch this so-called psychopath, no doubt a psychopath in the 70s, but I watch him now, 46 years later, manage that anger. I watch him have the anger, but the anger not have him. Or to use Paul's language, get angry, but sin not. And to see that reaction, you can't fake reactions. They're visceral. They come right out of the gut. And typically when someone's angry, the typical trajectory is they externalize. It's, you listen to them speak. It's all about people, places, things. They're pointing at the outward world. I watch David self-reflect for 3.5 hours. I watch him take responsibility, own. He makes a shocking confession to me, a secret that he'd been harboring for a long time in one of the final chapters of the book. Psychopaths don't own their bad decisions. Yeah. They constantly weasel out of responsibility. So David demonstrates all the qualities that fly in the face of the psychopath he was in the 1970s. And I'm a firm believer that after 34 sessions, seeing his reactions, not just actions, that he is not just the son of Sam, but he's become the son of hope and a son of God.
Yeah. Excellent. Excellent. So what's prison like, especially life in prison, for someone like David, especially with his status? And then even what's prison like for someone who's trying to be a Christian in prison? Can't imagine it's easy.
Well, the idea that people become a Christian in prison because it's the easier path, and that's why they become a Christ follower, is hogwash.
Yeah.
In prison, Christianity is perceived as weak.
Right.
You're really better off becoming an Islamist or a Muslim, you know, becoming some type of militant adherent, not a Christian. Christianity is perceived as weak. It's not understood for what it really is. Yeah. So you become a Christian. In fact, David ministers often to Muslims that will come to him in secret. He actually gifted one Muslim a Bible and had to hide it inside of a manila envelope, wrap it up a few times, and present it to him incognito because that Muslim inmate has eyes on him.
Right, right.
It's not the kind of gang you join for refuge. Being a Christian is the harder path. Now, for David, he's considered a pastor. He doesn't accept the title easily. He blushes, but they call him Pastor Dave. He's an older man, older than most of the inmates. He's 71 years old. They look up to him. He's a mentor. Mm-hmm. He's counseled many of them. So for him, he's got this pastoral, fatherly shepherd status within the prison, and he even organizes the chapel services in the middle of the week.
Wow. And so you did mention that David revealed something to you and you have it in the book that he hasn't spoken about before. So could you share a little bit of that? Because I know you want people to read it. So Maybe give us a little something that'll make us say, all right, we got to go get the book and we got to get that snippet.
Well, one of the big debates surrounding David Berkowitz, there was an entire documentary series on Netflix surrounding the cult and how involved the cult was in the killings.
The multiple shooters, right, and all of that.
Yeah, the debate whether it was a lone gunman or multiple shooters. David's confession in one of the final chapters puts an end to that debate. And it was a secret that he'd been keeping for a long time. So I'll leave it at that. I knew that there was something he wanted to share probably about 6 months into our meeting. I said, this guy's holding something back. I could see the neurosis surrounding the topic, just his defensiveness.
Right.
And finally, I got a phone call. I was cooking in the kitchen with my wife, and he calls me, and I collect call. And he said, Dr. Caparelli, I've got something I really need to come clean about. He said, you know, you pressed me our last session, because I pressed him a little bit. Not too far. I don't want to push him over the edge, but I pressed him. And it took some time to get to that point of pressing him. In behavioral science, we call it tactical empathy, not manipulation. I manipulate you to do what I want you to do. Tactical empathy is I form a bond with you, and I'm hoping that bond will lead you to the truth. And I use the influence. I steward the influence. I steward that influence, that bond of trust, that rapport, to maneuver you in a direction of truth.
Right.
So that tactical empathy, you know, I mean, hostage negotiators learn it. FBI learns it. Counselors certainly use it in their therapy sessions.
AA meetings, right? AA meetings. People AA go to the meetings. They'll never speak. And then eventually maybe they speak up on their trauma.
Absolutely. They hear other people's stories.
Yeah.
A bond is formed. Now they can say, okay, me too, I'm not alone in this. So that tactical empathy, I mean, it gets more sophisticated than the AANA group, the more you study behavioral science. But it got him to a point, finally, he confesses something that he had never told anybody. So I'll leave it at that. You can go read the book and see for yourself. Some of it does go back to an original confession. Some of it is a little bit more than that, but you can read it for yourself and see. But the point is, here's a guy who owns his role, and every characteristic you could think of a psychopath, he flies in the face of that because of the transforming power of the gospel.
Yeah, amazing. And can your information, your book, everything you've used, could that be used as part of his case or part of the, I don't know, could police do anything with it? Or is it kind of just so far removed from everything that he did that's just like, oh, this is just more information that's floating out there?
Well, the data that's collected is data that is done from a qualitative research point of view. It's data that can be included within the behavioral science database to have a better understanding of what we're dealing with when we deal with the psychopath. There's so much pop psychology out there. I mean, everybody's a psychologist today because they watch Criminal Minds or they're on the internet surfing the internet. And the more you surf, the more you get surface knowledge.
Yeah.
It's you're kind of skimming, you know. So the book is, in my opinion, is giving a more nuanced and accurate understanding of a psychopath, not as this monster from the abyss, but somebody who is a lot more similar to you and me than we'd like to admit. I mean, I gathered 9 themes. All of those themes are relevant to all of us. Isolation, shame, abandonment trauma, cognitive distortions, defense mechanisms. These are things that we experience and we do every day. Resentment. This is the stuff that makes up the human race, and it's the stuff that if you let it go too far, you'll find yourself committing misdeeds and then wondering what got into me. How many times have you blew it in some way and you said, man, I don't know what possessed me? Isn't that interesting language?
Right.
What possessed you?
Right.
I got carried away. It's as if something paranormal happened at some point that sort of just moved you further than you anticipated going, you know? And it's partly what's in you, but it's also partly what got into you. It's what's in you that came in contact with another realm that is Paul warns in Ephesians, be careful, you get angry, you let the sun go down on that anger, you give the devil a foothold. So we describe in great detail that spell, that possession that took over. And I hope that that knowledge does serve, maybe it'll serve the FBI, maybe it'll serve clinicians, teachers. I'm hoping really it just serves the average person. It's not a book that is too academic. I think anybody listening right now can go on, order it, and you're going to walk away and go, wow, this is relevant for me. Mm-hmm. It's not some, you know, highly academic book that I can't grasp it.
Yeah, I think people, you know, will automatically have an assumption sometimes when they see, you know, it's like a psychoanalysis book. But, you know, reading through the, skimming through a little bit as I was preparing for the interview, it's very conversational. It's very much like how you and I are talking right now. And you're reflecting on your own thoughts. You're reflecting on what he's saying. It's not this deep dive into psychology in a way that's going to make you say, ah, this is the class I skipped, you know, in college or high school.
Yeah, I think if you asked any of my students to take my courses, I teach at 3 colleges. I teach abnormal psych, general psych, criminal psych. They'll tell you, you know, when I leave Dr. Caparelli's class, I'm looking at myself more closely. Yeah. You know, it's really a journey of self-reflection because we as people, we're a lot more alike than we are different. Yeah. I mean, the Genome Project, which was gathering people's genetics across a span of time, decades, from all different parts of the world, its main finding is that we are 99% genetically similar, all human beings. I don't care where you're from, what background, we are 99% genetically similar. It's comical that we make a big deal about our distinctions when it's only 1% of our personality. That's our ego, our arrogance. We want to kind of stand out. Right. But the truth is, what makes me tick is what makes you tick. We're 99% genetically similar. We all need belonging. We all are enraged when we're rejected. We all are stuck on ourselves. I mean, I tell my students in my psychology class, you're all little narcissists. And they go, no, I'm not. I said, I'll prove it to you. Simple. I'll take a group photo of all of us, and then I'll show you the group photo. Whose face do you go looking for first? You look for your face. You don't look for your neighbor's face. And if your hair isn't right, we all got to line up, take the picture again, and drop another 30 on the photographer because you don't think you look good. So, you know, we're a lot more similar than we realize, and we make a big deal about our distinctions as if we're different from the herd. But the truth is, there's a fine line between David Berkowitz and the reader.
Yeah, and that's, I think it's a good segue for the next question. Like, do you think that's kind of why society seems to be fascinated with serial killers and crime and the like? It's sort of this reflection of ourselves in the mirror. Like, I know I wouldn't do it, but it might be cool to, like, you know, take a peek. And that's that mirror, that monster mirror that you're talking about.
Yeah, I think there are a few reasons why America is drawn to the serial killer, why true crime is the most popular genre within book sales and movies. The first reason is, I think, we want our psychopaths around. We want to know that that's a psychopath because it makes me feel a little bit better.
Okay.
It's kind of like the Pharisee and the tax collector, the parable where the Pharisee says, thank God I'm not like those prostitutes, drunkards, and tax collectors. We want to stand up and say, well, thank God I'm not like the psychopath. The psychopath makes me feel better about my own morality. It's kind of like that line in the movie Scarface where Tony Montana stands up at the restaurant and he says, you need bad guys like me. So why? So you can feel like a good guy.
Yeah.
So we want our bad guys, our beloved psychopaths, because they make us feel morally, you know, elevated. And probably the second reason is we do have subconscious wishes to hurt. And being anonymous, surveys reveal that the preponderance of people would commit awful crimes against each other if they could get away with it. And there's a lot of data on that has been collected by behavioral scientists to show we have these wishes to hurt, and oftentimes it's law and order, or maybe guilt that keeps us in place. So you watch a movie, you read a book, and there's a vicarious thing that's happening, where I can sort of get a release on what I'm feeling through someone else, and even glow in that. And then I think another reason why we like our psychopaths and serial killers, to take a page out of Dr. Jordan Peterson's book, was just a tremendous blessing right now, I believe, to the culture, and reconciling morality back to psychology. Yeah. He's a real voice. But he often says, and I agree with him, that we love the anti-hero, especially, or the villain that's cool, like a Dr. Hannibal Lecter, yeah, because we're trying to reconcile our dark side, the shadow, as Carl Jung would call it, trying to reconcile the shadow with our virtuous side. And it's an integration. And we see this kind of in a Dr. Lecter, who's sort of charming in one hand. You know, he's saving Clarice Starling's yeah. life, keeping her safe from the hogs, and chops off his own hand to protect her. But at the same time, he's a bad boy. So he's a bad boy and he's a good man, all wrapped up in one. I say good loosely, but he's got these qualities of mm-hmm. goodness as well as badness. And we're all seeking for that wholeness, that integration of the shadow, the darker side of us with the virtuous side. So that's what Dr. Peterson's answer would be. And I think that that's also part and parcel for why we're drawn to the serial killer and drawn to true crime.
Yeah, you brought up references, and I'm getting hit with so many like movie ideas and references based on things you're saying. So the second point you had kind of made was how, you know, a lot of data suggests that if there wasn't law and order, people would do these things. So you have those movies, you know, the Purge movies. I don't know if you've ever seen them. So you think those movies would be closer to reality than not reality?
Well, history will show you that.
Yeah.
You go through different periods of history where mankind is under great pressure. Mankind is in some very anomalous conditions and circumstances, and the behaviors that manifest. I mean, you get a little whiff of it here and there. COVID-19 hits, panic. People are killing each other for toilet paper. Not literally killing each other, but quickly, how quickly we mm-hmm. change under certain circumstances. And then we isolate during 2020 and 21. We're all quarantined. What happens? Lots of contention. We get very aggressive. You think the aggression on social media was just because of politics and just because of George Floyd? That was some of it. But when you're isolating, you're pulling away from people. Strange things happen in isolation. Mm-hmm. Aggression levels go up, which is marked by cortisol and adrenaline. Oxytocin levels go down, which is marked by, which is a demonstration of empathy. So we become more aggressive, less empathetic, the more we isolate.
Yeah.
And now in that isolation, we're on social media, like the contention in 2020 and 21 was off the charts.
Yeah.
And one of the underpinnings of that contention, the underpinning, was isolation. It was one of the underbellies of why there was this craziness and this behavior, because we weren't as properly integrated into community. And man does not do good alone. I mean, I don't know what Adam was doing in the Garden of Eden. I don't know if he was chasing a pigeon with a stick, slamming his head up against a tree, but God said, this brother needs a friend, quick. Let's make him a friend. He can't be alone. It's not good for man to be alone. Of course, I'm being facetious right now, but the point is clear. We're social creatures. The most introverted person listening tonight is still a social creature. You still need a dose of community. And without it, you and I don't do well. How much focus in the New Testament on assimilating into the body of Christ? How much focus on becoming a part of not just God, but the people of God?
Yeah.
Because we just don't do well alone. And David Berkowitz's story is a great example of that. He's just an outsider, like so many mass shooters, this man on the fringes. I mean, one of the letters he wrote, left it at the crime scene in between two bodies. I'm an outsider watching the world go by, programmed to kill. I mean, tying those two ideas together, outsider, programmed to kill, isolation, violence, they go hand in hand. I'm not saying it's the only thing that made him a killer. I mean, isolation is one ingredient in a recipe, but it does play a part. Before the Germans executed the Jews during World War II, there was lots of social distancing that first happened. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of, you stay there, we're here. And in that social distancing, empathy's going down, the erosion of empathy.
Yeah.
Now we have objectification. You're an object. You're not a person. Now it's easy to discard you, to put you in an oven, because you're not a person, you're an object. That took time. That's an evolution, and it began with social distancing.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I think it's funny you brought up the word community during 2020, right? Nobody had it. I actually, so this is a weekly thing that I just started doing. The last weekly Instagram live show I had was during COVID, and it was called Community During Chaos. And it was my way of almost like a therapy show. I had the same four questions for every guest that I had on. And it was essentially, how are you coping with everything that's going on? You know, what are you doing to try to be an influence or a positive change with the platform you have? And, you know, four questions kind of directed in that way. And like, how are you doing mentally, emotionally, spiritually? And, you know, having those really tough conversations during that chaos was the hardest thing that I'd ever done in my life. I did it for 25 straight weeks, 75 interviews, three people a show. After that, it took me 3 or 4 years to come back and do and have like a concept for a weekly Instagram show because I was just drained. Mm. So I understand exactly what you're talking about, because we all collectively are going through some sort of chaos regardless of the circumstance. And it's how we use our community and how we use our ability, whether that's faith, mental fortitude, whatever it is, family, to try to survive that. And that's what we all have in common.
One of the reasons why David Berkowitz has functioned so well the last 35 years, been incarcerated 46, but he gave his life to Christ 35 years ago. It's not just God, it's the people of God. He has found community within that prison that he never found in free society. So he is very much a part of that community. He has a role to play. He's valued, he's esteemed, he's looked up to. You know, those basic Maslow's hierarchy of inherent needs, those inherent needs, the need to belong, the need to feel esteemed, the need to feel safe, those needs are met within the community at the prison. I mean, listen, we go back centuries in our makeup as people. We're tribal. We've always been tribal. Now, it may look more sophisticated than it did with primitive man, but that primitive brain is still there. And when we isolate, to be cut off from a tribe, survival mechanisms kick in pretty quick, because in a jungle, if you're away from the herd, you're away from the tribe, you go into fight flight mode. Yeah. Studies have been done on isolation to take rodents. University of Japan, which I think is interesting, the University of Japan did this because they suffer greatly from the lack of community, and introversion is not just a personality trait there, but it's become a paralysis in many cases, where the Japanese are kind of staying to themselves. But University of Japan, probably because of this cultural phenomenon, took a group of rodents. They remove a sample of the rodents, isolate them for a period of time, return them back to their community, not a different community, their own community.
Okay.
At the point of reentry, the isolated rodents attack their own community after the isolation, because isolation, it's funny. We've been talking this way for years. I mean, you've gone to parties, right? Yeah. Remember going to parties back in the day and somebody's arguing a lot with everybody at the party? What do you say? You don't get out much. Yeah. That's usually the phrase you say. Because mm-hmm. intuitively, we know if people don't get out much,
they don't know how to act around people enough,
they don't know how to relate to people.
Yeah. That's fascinating. So with that being said, do you feel that prison, and also a loaded question, does prison work as a rehabilitation center for people going back into society?
Unfortunately, for most, it does not.
Okay.
It's really what you put in, and that's going to reflect what you get out.
Yeah.
I work with two other serial killers before David Berkowitz, not as notorious. They were guys that were more regional in my area, and no transformation whatsoever. One of them, I probably spent too much time. I went years with him. There was a lot of psychopathic games,
Yeah.
and no change whatsoever. So David Berkowitz is, he's in a smaller margin of people that actually have put a lot into his walk with God and into his character development. And because of that, he's gotten a lot out of it. He's reached out to people on the outside, like Pastor Don Wilkerson and many others that have helped invest in him. But the majority don't change. But I got news for you. The majority of people at large don't
Don't
change.
change.
I mean, look, how many times you meet a guy, it's been 30 years since you've seen him, you saw him in high school, and you're like, oh my goodness, it's the same. It's the same stories, same stupid jokes, same idiosyncrasies, same character defects, same habits. He's hanging on the same corner. I mean, Isaac Newton's first law of motion, everything is staying in a state of inertia, stagnation, until something puts pressure on it to move. So for David Berkowitz, that pressure was incarceration. It was being in that prison for 10 years and various crises that he erupted that brought him to Christ. Most people, though, are not changing. Listen, some people learn by seeing the light. Most people learn by feeling the heat. And even those that feel the heat, it can take a lot of heat before they wake up and they learn something. David is part of the smaller margin of people within the prison system. The preponderance of inmates never experience change.
Yeah, it's a shame. All right, here's another loaded question. How do we forgive the unforgivable, and how do the unforgivable people live with themselves?
Well, you asked that question and it brings to mind Nathan Moskowitz. I told you about Stacy. Stacy said, Mom, don't worry about me. I'm going out tonight, having a good time. And this serial killer that's set loose in New York City is not targeting blondes. I'll be safe. And Stacy was David Berkowitz's last victim. Well, Nathan hated David Berkowitz. She hated him for many years. She was on Geraldo Rivera, many talk shows throughout the 80s and the 90s, and she wished him dead. She called him a dog. She said she'd do anything to see him die. And then in the 1990s, a miracle happened. Moskowitz forgave David Berkowitz and began a relationship with him, a friendship. And David Berkowitz gave me access to all the letters between the two of them.
Wow.
So I saw the breakthrough of forgiveness. In fact, can I say this prophetically to somebody? There's somebody listening right now. You need to change your therapist. Any therapist that doesn't tell you about forgiveness, but all they want to talk about is boundaries, there's a problem with that. Boundaries are important, very important. But at some point, you have to forgive because who's going to protect you from you? The boundaries may protect you from the perpetrator, but your unforgiveness is going to keep you at peril to yourself. So get a therapist that's going to talk about forgiveness. Get a therapist that's going to talk about the power of forgiveness. Forgiveness doesn't mean trust. Doesn't mean that you're entering into a close covenant with that person again. I mean, Jesus said there's certain people that we should treat like the tax collectors. Tax collectors, you didn't trust them.
Right.
They were hustlers. They were trying to swindle you of money. So it's okay to not trust people, but you got to forgive. And if you don't forgive, it puts you in jeopardy. It puts you in jeopardy before God and before yourself. So forgiveness is the way out. And if you're seeing any therapist that's not encouraging that, I'd find a counselor pretty quickly. Now, forgiveness begins by acknowledging the offense. You can't shortcut forgiveness. And one of the ways that people will shortcut forgiveness, and they don't ever really get the benefits of forgiveness, they don't reap the true benefits, is they minimize or rationalize what was done to them. So they make excuses for the person that hurt
Yeah.
them. Well, he didn't mean it. Well, he too comes from a bad background. Well, it wasn't that bad. Well, other people suffered worse. You have to acknowledge the weight, the gravity of the
That's
offense. You have to forgive from the acknowledgement of the offense. To numb the offense or to dull it, to make it minimize it, make it less, is a shortcut because you really remove the offense. You really have nothing to forgive in your mind, at least,
Yeah.
and your forgiveness at this point is just lip service, and you don't really reap the benefits of freedom and peace. So step one is, I'm angry. I was hurt.
That's
and
okay.
It's okay to say that. It's okay to say that sometimes to the person who hurt you. It's okay to say it to yourself. Certainly say it to someone you trust. But once you get past that stage of acknowledging the offense and even maybe even grinding your teeth a little bit, Bible says be angry. At some point, and it's a process, you've got to work towards that forgiveness, because if not, you can have all the boundaries in the world up against your perpetrator. But what about you? You're going to do more harm to you than any perpetrator could ever do.
Yeah. Great. Great stuff. Man, I feel like I can do this for hours. I'm not going to do that to you. So I'm going to wrap it up here. But is your story with David, in terms of this project specifically, is that over? And are there any ideas that have come out of doing this project that you want to pursue kind of based around this?
Well, no, my friendship with David will continue from now until eternity. I'll be visiting him the end of January, be seeing him January the 29th, Monday. I'll be there probably 3-4 hours just as a friend. Mm-hmm. So the friendship will continue. The book has been written, but now it's exposure, it's promotions, it's telling the story, a story to a culture that is fixated on other people being psychopaths, other people being narcissists. It's a story that I think is very relevant for this hour. And David is, believe it or not, helping me with some of that. He's got his own contacts. You know, I've been on lots of talk shows, podcasts, radio shows, you name it. So I'm going to spend a lot of time in 2024. I'm in 18 states, traveling, speaking in churches, schools, prisons, rehabs, telling the story, as well as making the book available. So the work continues with Monster Mirror, at least until through 2024. I wouldn't mind doing it again with somebody else. I do have somebody reading it right now that's also behind bars, that is also one of America's notorious, you know, killers, that's now a Christian, and he's reading it, and maybe the journey would happen with him again. You know, that I had with David, I did enjoy seeing grace in gritty places.
Yeah.
The grace of God in some very gritty, dark places. I mean, light is best seen against the dark backdrop. So to see the light of the gospel shine against the depravity of man, what a beautiful sight.
Yeah.
I would definitely be willing to do the journey again. But at least for 2024, it's going to be a lot of bringing exposure to the Monster Mirror story.
Yeah, absolutely. And I see it on Amazon, tons of reviews, 4.9, I think, reviews out of 5. So maybe one person was like slightly upset about something, like really just something minute. But it happened, 4.9, you take that.
It actually ranked, the book came out, has sold thousands since its release in October. I really want to see tens of thousands and then hundreds of thousands, that it would make that impact for the kingdom. But it ranked number one the first week in the serial killer category. Now, I would rather it rank number one there than in the religious books category.
Because people are going to be going there to see what it's about.
Fish with this fish. Yeah. Why do I want to fish in a pond where, you know, these people know Christ? It's in the serial killer category. That's a dark category. Well, that's where the book shined as number one on Amazon for the first week. So bring it on.
All right. So we covered a vast variety of things. Is there anything else you want to say, add, plug, let everybody know that we didn't discuss?
On Amazon today, it's been marked down for this interview. I marked it down from, I think, $19.99 to $16.99. You can get it in Kindle. You can get the Spanish version. I don't know how to speak Spanish, but if you just type in Monster Mirror, I'm not going to attempt to say it. If you type in Monster Mirror in your Spanish tongue, you'll find a copy in Spanish. You can get it in Kindle, paperback, or you can go to Barnes & Noble, one of the two. But it's been a pleasure being on this Rapzilla. I got my daughters watching, and Ashley, Hannah, Olivia, love you. And
Yeah, this has been amazing. Thank you so much. And for people who are joining, coming in and out, I see a lot of faces. Right after we're done here, this is going to upload right onto the Instagram page. Then I'm going to download it. It'll be on YouTube. We'll make some clips. We'll share it. So you'll be seeing this for the next couple of weeks. So if anyone heard something that they want to hear again, or they're like, oh, I missed it, it'll be right there that you can watch it. Michael, thank you so much. I'm looking forward to see what you got next. And this has been a pleasure. Thanks for making this Christian hip hop show a little more out of the box, which is perfectly fine with me. I talk to artists all day, all the time. It's nice to actually speak to someone else who writes things. It makes me feel at home.
I was going to try to string together some rhymes for the show to be appropriate, but it wasn't happening. So
I think you're better off. I think you're better off that way. All right. Thank you. Thank you so much. Have a good night.
You have a great night. God bless you. Thank you for having me on.
All right. Bye. All right. So everybody, that was Michael Caparelli, Monster Mirror, his book about the 100 hours that he spent with David Berkowitz, aka the Son of Sam, serial killer. If you've tuned in at some point and you want to know what we were talking about, or you caught something, you're like, oh man, I wish I would have seen that. And this is going to be uploaded right now to the page. All right. So I will see you all next week. I believe we will have, who are we going to have next week? Sorry. We're going to have Sis and Lil Bro next week. So next Wednesday. I will see you all later. Peace.